This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Glad you're joining me. We've got 2 hours in front of us. You have heard probably by now, I would think, that 49 people have been confirmed dead after shootings at two mosques in the New Zealand city of Christchurch. 41 people died at Al Noor Mosque and 7 at Linwood Mosque. Another victim died later at the hospital. 48 people being treated for injuries, including young children. I have a few comments about the event and also the thought, the philosophy, the delusion of the man responsible for the murders. Also, I want to talk a little bit about Jack Phillips and his victory at the Supreme Court. Again, he is the owner of Masterpiece Cakes. We'll also talk today with Dr. Daniel Philpott from the University of Notre Dame about religious freedom in Islam. It may sound like a contradiction here. What is the fate of what we consider a universal human right? We believe all people yearn to be free, right? And that includes religious liberty. Well, what do you do when you've got a major worldview, 1 billion Muslims around the world, who don't accept, who simply don't accept religious liberty? Are there any pockets of Muslim influence where, in fact, there's something that we would recognize as religious liberty? Also coming up today, Archbishop Joseph Nauman from the Archdiocese of Kansas City. As you may have heard already, there's a little bit of a controversy in Kansas City because a Catholic school there decided to not enroll a child in kindergarten. That child is son of a same-sex couple. And so the problem is, well, do we want conflict? Because we're going to be teaching what the church teaches about same-sex marriage. And this boy is going to be going through a great deal. We're going to talk it over with Archbishop Nauman. And there'll be more, too. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, March 15th. It is the Feast of St. Louis de Marillac. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, bringing loving care and assistance to seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. The death toll so far in the New Zealand mosque attacks is 49. NBC reporter Sarah James is at the Christchurch Hospital where the wounded are being treated. She says it's been busy there.
Using about 12 different operating rooms as they continue to help 48 people who were injured in the attack.
Police Commissioner Mike Bush says the vast majority of the victims were killed at one mosque in Christchurch. One man, Australian Brenton Tarrant, has already been charged with murder, and three other people are in custody in what's being called a coordinated attack. The attacks happened during Friday prayers. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has called the shootings a terror attack. It's the worst massacre in New Zealand in 30 years. North Korea may be going back to a hardline approach with the United States. We get details from correspondent Bill Zinfer.
It appears that North Korea is now giving the United States an ultimatum. North Korea's vice foreign minister is quoted as saying the U.S. was to blame for the breakdown of last month's Vietnam summit, and North Korea may go back to missile and nuclear tests unless the U.S. makes concessions. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is expected to make an official announcement in the near future on the status of talks with the United States. Bill Zimper, NBC News Radio.
And social media may be responsible for increased mental health issues among teenagers. A new study found that the amount of U.S. teens and young adults who experience mental distress, depression, and suicidal thoughts or actions rose significantly over the last 10 years. There was an especially large spike in 2011, which researchers cite as the year that social media emerged. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. As I said earlier, we've got this terrible shooting in New Zealand, 49 killed at two mosques. And it reminds me and reminds others of what happened in Norway back in 2011 with Anders Breivik, Very similar. In fact, Åsne Seierstad, who's been on this program, Norwegian journalist, who's done the best work on the Breivik murders in Norway, she's pointed out that today's terrorist, what now is yesterday's terrorist, mimics Breivik, both in ideas and methods, and in the concept of brother knights. Now, if you remember, Breivik had claimed he had a whole cluster of followers around the world who were going to take up his cause. Of course, there was no evidence of that. That was his crime, committed his crime back, I believe it was 2011. And so here we are, 2019, and some other fella steps forward. Breivik had written a big manifesto called the European Declaration, and this fellow has given us a manifesto called The Great Replacement. So I'm reading through the manifesto to see what it is that he wants to communicate, and I'm struck. I am struck, just like I was struck when I was studying the Breivik case in Norway. These are both men who are, in some very significant ways, disconnected from reality. In other words, they don't live. They're not very good reality testers. They have a tremendous amount of social isolation as well. In this case, the story goes right now, we've been unable to locate any particular person that this perpetrator was connected to. No wife, mother, father, sister, brother, friends. Claims that he has some buddies in the Neo Knights Templar, but that doesn't seem to be any formal group or anything. No great accomplishments. Of course, he's only 28 years old, so still young. But it's interesting that he talked about a murder, a terrorist murder of an 11-year-old girl. And he engraves the name of the 11-year-old girl on his rifle, but there's no attempt to contact the parents. In other words, there's no embeddedness in this man's life. He lives distant from the world, and that translates to the way he sees the world. So, for instance, you say, why New Zealand? Well, New Zealand is thought to be a relatively peaceful place. But he went to New Zealand because of Muslim immigration and Muslim fertility rates there. Well, wait a minute. What are those? So in New Zealand, for instance, over the last 10 years, Christians have dropped from 54% of the population to 47% of the population. 7% Christians have dropped. Those who claim no religion have jumped by 7%, 35 to 42%. In New Zealand, they've got about 2% Hindu. They've grown a little bit. Buddhists, about the same, 1.5% over the same period. Islam has grown from roughly 1% to 1.2%. There's no huge infusion of Muslim population there. And so he says, well, check out their fertility rates. Well, we don't have the fertility rates for New Zealand, I'm sorry to say, but this idea that Muslims are breeding like rabbits and are somehow going to displace other people is way, way overblown. So, for instance, in France, they're about 7.5% Muslim. And in social surveys, those who live in France tend to think that it's more like 1 in 3, about 33% Muslim. There's this idea that Muslims have more children. Well, they do. In this first generation, Muslims did have more children. So, for instance, in Austria, they had about 2 children more than other native Austrians. But after 20 years, it's dropped. It's dropped to only 1 child more. You have the same thing in Germany. So you don't have this This idea that Muslims continue to breed at high levels when they're in the West, it simply isn't true. It looks as though, and we'll know by within a generation, if their fertility rates are going to be similar to what happened to the West in United States and North America and in Europe, which is that they tend towards zero population. And, of course, in Europe right now, there's a birth dearth. And that so even if you're at even if you're just reproducing yourself, you're way ahead because a lot of countries in Europe are not reproducing themselves. So but the point is, Muslims look like they pretty much accommodate to the surrounding culture in Europe and in the United States, at least in the first generation. There seems to be declining fertility rates. Nevertheless, there's this disconnect between reality and the fantasy that is spun in this guy's mind about his own self-importance. Again, his idea is that he's sparking a revolution. It just strikes me again that these self-appointed revolutionaries who act alone often have inflated notions of their own importance, and they are not very good at connecting with the external world. So, for instance, this is a man who wants to teach New Zealand people to resist Muslims. So he kills men, women, and children, innocents. He says, of course, they're invaders, they're not innocent. But what ends up happening? He creates sympathy. He creates sympathy for the Muslims that he doesn't want there. So instead of creating an inhospitable environment, he actually creates a stronger climate of sympathy and acceptance, because human beings don't like to see the innocent slaughtered, no matter what disagreements you might have. So if you remember when there was a massacre at a Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh, Muslim groups raised about $200,000. Well, right now, a Jewish group is raising significant money in order to return the gesture. You kill innocent people, you create sympathy for innocent people. Christians are supposed to be connected to reality. We believe God ordains reality. We believe that faith and reason operate together to give us a better grip on what's here and what is coming in the future age. Jesus says, if you don't believe me when I tell you about earthly things, how are you going to believe me when I tell you about heavenly things? Behind that statement is the idea that a person with spiritual integrity and attraction is going to be able to speak about earthly things in a clear and real way. In other words, we do know earthly realities, and that's why you can trust us when we discuss heavenly realities. It seems to be just the opposite with these kind of self-important revolutionaries. They seem to always be telling us about their fantasies, but when it comes to the real world, they're not embedded in it. They're not really connected to it. Now, let me tell you about a man who is, in fact, connected to it, and that's Jack Phillips, the Colorado cake artist, who's been prosecuted twice for refusing to make cakes for events that contradict his religious belief. It seems as though the law is finally going to let him alone. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission announced last week that it will dismiss its most recent charges against Phillips. Now, this comes in the wake of newly discovered evidence that the state of Colorado had an ongoing hostility toward religious freedom. This is the case made by the Alliance Defending Freedom, who's been defending Jack since 2016. Now, it's been 6.5 years since Jack first found himself in trouble for turning down a same-sex couple who wanted him to make a wedding cake for them. Now, Phillips, as you know, is a Christian. He's willing to serve same-sex people. I mean, but he doesn't want to put his artistic stamp on his weddings, on their weddings, excuse me. His faith doesn't countenance so-called gay marriage. So these customers were frustrated, and they complained to the Colorado authorities. They held that he had violated the state anti-discrimination laws, and then Phillips appealed the decision on religious freedom grounds. Well, the state Civil Rights Commission then took up the cause of the complaints. There were a series of rulings and appeals, ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court as Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and in June of last year, the justices ruled 7-2 in favor of Phillips. And they were really influenced by evidence that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had acted without the religious neutrality that the Constitution requires. In other words, they were hostile to Phillips' religious beliefs. Now, at the same time, they were creating another effort to force Phillips into submission. A year before, on the very day the Supreme Court had agreed to take up the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, an attorney asked Phillips to create a cake designed pink on the inside and blue on the outside to celebrate a gender transition from male to female. Phillips declined the request because, you know, for the same reason, it violated his own deeply held religious beliefs. The man later asked Phillips to design a cake with satanic themes and images. So obviously he's targeting Phillips. Less than a month after the Supreme Court ruled for Phillips in his first case, the state surprised him by finding probable cause to believe that Colorado law requires him to create the requested gender transition cake. Well, that's the case that has now been dismissed because there's been new evidence found that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission has maintained an ongoing hostility to religious freedom, and in particular, the case of Jack Phillips. We'll have it posted for you at AveMariaRadio.net. Just go to the Cresta Guest Archives. I'm Al Cresta. Stay with me. We got great things coming up this hour.
Was St. Patrick the real inspiration for celebrating St. Patrick's Day? Yes, he was. He spread Christianity throughout Ireland, and which spread throughout Europe and eventually America. Hi, I'm Dan Hall from Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram, and you can experience Christianity and the luck of the Irish during the Ram Truck Month and our spring sales event going on now. Lease a new Ram 4x4 Bighorn or a new Jeep Grand Cherokee for only $239 per month. Come in and experience this for yourself only at Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram or visit us online at PinckneyChrysler.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to MyCatholicHealthCare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthCare.com. CMF Curo. Healthcare. Fully alive.
Come celebrate the Feast of St. Joseph, spouse of Mary, and patron of the Universal Church at beautiful historic St. Joseph Oratory across from the Eastern Market in Detroit on Tuesday, March 19th. Masses at 8 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. All-day devotions and confession. Church tour. Outdoor procession at 5:30 p.m. with the faithful from the parishes from the Archdiocese, St. Joseph table, and more. Please visit historicrenewal.com or stjosephoratory.org.
Catholic Charities provides aid to 10 million people across the United States. Consider a donor advised fund with Catholic Charities USA, an effective way to give, realizing senior tax benefits and assuring your investment is used in accordance with Catholic social teaching. Minimal initial contribution is lower than most donor advised funds. To learn more, go to ccusa.gives/legacy or call 1-833-323-4483.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEO in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting on the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
How do we define sin? The Catholic Catechism defines it in detail, calling sin an offense against reason, truth, and right conscience, a failure in genuine love for God and neighbor, caused by a perverse attachment to certain goods. St. Augustine defines sin as an utterance, a deed, or a desire contrary to the eternal law. It is an offense against God. King David lamented, "Against you, and you alone, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight." We sin when we love ourselves even to contempt of God. The Catechism points out that sin in all its ugly forms is exercised against Christ during the Passion. Ironically, at this darkest hour, the light of Christ's sacrifice becomes the inexhaustible source for the forgiveness of sin. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. One thing that many of us had hoped for after 9/11, 2001, is that there'd be a wide public debate about the nature of Islam. I think most people recognize that what Al-Qaeda represented within the Islamic community was one approach to dealing with the West. But there were other cases, too. We had Saudi Arabia, we had Egypt, we had Indonesia. The strange thing about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda is that they were a non-government actor, basically what we call a terrorist group in this case. Now, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of great public debate about Islam after 9/11. When President Obama became president, you might remember the Cairo talk that he gave, in which probably the first time that an American president directed his speech to a world religion. And that didn't really lead, it seems to me, to the kind of public debate that we need about Islam. Why do we need a debate? Well, there's a billion Muslims in the world, and they're not going away. Islam's not going away. And it's necessary to just figure out, is how do we live with our deepest differences, and what are those differences? We commonly hear that Islam regards democracy as a heresy, that historically we don't see what we recognize as religious freedom as a component in Islam. But it's probably a good time for us to look a little more closely at this. With me is Dr. Daniel Philpott. He's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. His research focuses on religion and global politics, emphasizing reconciliation and religious freedom. Dan has worked on the Under Caesar's Sword project for years, and we've talked with him many times. Recently, he's published Religious Freedom in Islam, The Fate of a Universal Human Right in the Muslim World Today. Dan, good to have you back with me. Thanks.
Yeah, great to be back again, Al. Thanks.
Well, this is, again, it's been a little frustrating to watch this discussion over the years. Historically, it's hard to get excited, for me anyways, it's hard to get excited looking at the question of religious freedom within Islam. It doesn't seem, at least on the street, that there's a great priority given to religious, what we would call in the West, religious liberty. We do have some places that where things are better than others. Indonesia is commonly pointed to, where they have a little more religious freedom. I guess I want to. You've given this a lot of thought, enough to actually give us a book on it. So I'll ask you just a blunt question to begin with: is there religious freedom in any Muslim-dominated country that we would recognize as religious freedom?
Well, thank you, Al. Yeah, in the book I look at that question head on, and I look at the 47 or so countries in the world that are Muslim majority countries. And the satellite view, if you look at all of the countries and add up their scores, I use the Pew Forum here, it does indeed bear out a pessimistic view of Islam. The average is much lower than the global average and still lower than the average of Christian majority countries. However, when you take a closer look, there's more diversity in the landscape. In fact, 11 out of the 47 Muslim-majority countries are, in fact, religiously free. And that's almost one-fourth. These are more than outliers, and I think there's something significant here. The greatest concentration of them is in West Africa. I call them the West Africa Seven. And there you have a collection of Muslim-majority countries that are actually renowned for their levels of tolerance and religious freedom. And, in fact, they're very devout. Sometimes secular people say, well, you can only have freedom when religiosity decreases. But in fact, this is one of the most religious parts of the world. And I would argue it's due not despite Islam, but because of the kind of Islam that is prevalent there. It's a Sufi Islam, and which emphasizes interiority and freedom. And then I would also look at the
So it's not very Arab then.
Well, that's very true. And for me, it's not Arab culture that matters so much, but in the Arab world, Islam came through conquest. Muhammad started it, you know, during his life, and, you know, it spread rapidly throughout what we call the Middle East now through conquest. Well, it was different in West Africa. There it was brought by bands of traders and missionaries who, from the beginning, had to make accommodations with the local authorities. And that pattern of making accommodations has, you know, persisted through the ensuing centuries.
No, that's fascinating. So name the countries for me, the seven. Give me the West Africa Seven.
Now you're quizzing me here.
I don't grade very harshly on this.
Well, being a professor, I'm not used to this. So Mali, Senegal, Sierra Leone, the Gambia, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Niger. I think that's it. Did I pass?
Not bad. Some of those names, most of us don't even recognize.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
So they have a very different experience then, the way Islam was brought to them and how they grew up with it. I'm just curious then, what do they do with the grand myth of Islamic conquest, which at least in the Sunni-based Muslim groups that I've listened to, this idea of the 7th century conquest, I mean, that's often considered an apologetic point in the defense of Islam. Look how successful we were.
Right, yes. Well, yes, I don't think in West Africa. Now these are Sunnis, by the way. Now there's the Sufi spirituality, but they're still Sunnis.
But they're still Sunnis. Okay,
that's right. And I would think that they would not regard conquest as essential, as something that's Quranic or that is intrinsic to the religion. I think it's important to remember too that the conquest is the Arab model, but in fact Arabs are only 15% of all Muslims in the world.
Yeah.
And of course, in our popular image, we associate it with Saudi Arabia and Iran and so forth.
Right.
But in fact, there are great Muslim populations concentrated in places like West Africa, Southeast Asia. You know, Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world.
Yeah, I think India is the second largest Muslim country.
Yeah, that's right, and they're only 14% of the population. but yes, you're right, yes.
Yeah, so this is... I'm kind of jumping way ahead here. Assuming then that there is a model of Islam which can tolerate some measure of religious freedom as we understand it, who speaks on behalf of world Islam? Or do we need anybody to speak on behalf of world Islam in the same way that maybe the Pope speaks on behalf of world Catholicism?
It's a great question. And in fact, Islam, you know, does not have a pope. It is sometimes said that, you know, the kind of version coming out of Saudi Arabia because it's associated with the original sites, Mecca and Medina, is maybe more authoritative.
Right.
But I don't think that need be the case. Again, there simply is no pope. Now, you can speak of a kind of consensus of jurists or consensus of clerics on certain issues. Again, there's no one that kind of speaks authoritatively in the name of everyone. And there is both peril and possibility in that. Peril because people can come up with interpretations that lead to, you know, terrible violence and terrorism and so forth. But also possibility in that people can also envision, new developments, something like a doctrinal development, as we think about it in the Catholic tradition.
Do they have a line of reflection that corresponds with how Catholics think of doctrinal development?
Well, not precisely, again, because there's not a pope or a, you know, very firm body of what is thought of as magisterial tradition. But Muslims are very concerned to root their teachings in the tradition, in the Quran, in the Hadith, in historical experience. And now, to be honest, I want the book to be honest is one of the qualities of it. Mm-hmm. Religious freedom is a minority opinion today.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there are some very brave voices who are developing a doctrine of religious freedom in a very compelling way. You've had Mustafa Akyol on the show.
Yes, Mustafa's been with us. Yeah.
There's Abdullah Saeed and any number of other thinkers who are kind of the John Courtney Murrays and Jacques Maritains who are kind of thinking about how, much as the Catholic Church did at the Second Vatican Council, how we might be able to get behind religious freedom in a way that is consistent with and consonant with the tradition.
So do we have then parallels between the Catholic dealing with religious liberty at the Second Vatican Council and what might happen within the Islamic world? Is there something that we look in terms of our own history? Exactly what was the status of religious liberty in Catholic doctrine prior to the Second Vatican Council?
That's right. That's very important. And in fact, I have a chapter in the book where I look at Dignitatis Humanae as a pathway for Islam. And in fact, the Catholic Church had not authoritatively taught or embraced religious freedom prior to the Second Vatican Council. And there was a widespread sort of political doctrine that held that, you know, you both wanted to have an established Catholic Church in the state, if possible. That was the ideal. And also that it was justifiable to coerce expressions of religious faith that were not compatible with Catholicism. And again, I think that was a widely held political doctrine that was kind of operative for the Church, but not, as it turns out, say, a dogmatic teaching. And at the same time, there are also some what I call seeds of freedom in the Catholic tradition that were used to kind of weave together a doctrine of religious freedom. In the early church, there were thinkers like Tertullian and Lactantius who did espouse religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And even thinkers like Aquinas and Augustine, although they, as we all know, they did teach the legitimacy of coercion, they also taught doctrines like the fundamentally and critically free character of the act of faith and embrace of the faith. Well, those, again, proved to be seeds that could be used to weave together the doctrine of Dignitatis Humanae at the council.
Okay. Can you stay with me in another segment, Dan?
Yes, I'd love to.
Good. I'm going to continue with Dr. Dan Philpott. Religious freedom in Islam, the fate of a universal human right in the Muslim world today. Again, clearly a minority position within Islam, and we've discussed it on this program before. What we want to do is see, is there any possibility... Does the Islamic tradition have contained within it its own possible seeds of freedom? We'll be right back.
Catholic Charities provides aid to 10 million people across the United States. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities USA, an effective way to give, realizing same-year tax benefits and assuring your investment is used in accordance with Catholic social teaching. Minimal initial contribution is lower than most donor-advised funds. To learn more, go to ccusa.gives/legacy. or call 1-833-323-4483.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. I want to announce that Steve Ray and I will be going on pilgrimage to the great land of Poland, August 21st to August 30th.
We're going to follow John Paul II, Maria Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and Maximilian Kolbe. We're even going to visit Auschwitz and see the place where Maximilian Kolbe gave his life in the cell there.
People can get more information at AveMariaRadio.net. And where else, Steve?
CatholicConvert.com. Click on the big pilgrimage banner or call 866-468-1420.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, deli, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalace.net.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the third Healing the Breach of Trust Conference on March 26th in our nation's capital. Engage with some of the best Catholic minds in the country, including experts in organizational behavior and journalists presenting competing views of the role of sexuality and of clericalism, and a deeper analysis about the root causes of the Church's crisis. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Fire on the Earth's Peter Herbeck on the devil's plan during Lent.
Satan is demanding, and he wants to seduce all of God's creation. Men and women were made to love God and to love one another and to freely offer our lives to Him. That's the whole meaning of human existence in a nutshell. That's it. And the devil says, no, I demand that I be the center, that I be the focus, and you will worship me. Jesus resisted it. That same battle is happening in your life and mine. If we don't see it, it's because we're blind. The devil, he's got a perfect plan. He's got a bad plan, and he's going to work that plan. He's going to say, where are Peter's vulnerabilities? Is he easily distracted? Is he vain? Can I get him there? Is he full of lust? Can I get him there? Is he proud? Does he need to feel superior to other people? How can we get him? And the enemy will just keep circling and circling. And he just works us and works us. And so the season of Lent isn't just a season of letting things go, which we need to. It's not just a time of self-emptying, but the self-emptying needs to happen so that we can be filled.
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Dan Philpott, professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author most recently of Religious Freedom in Islam, The Fate of a Universal Human Right in the Muslim World Today. We are looking at the possibility of religious freedom, but also the barriers to such a thing. So, for instance, throughout Muslim history, religious liberty has not been a prized value. Secondly, you've got multiple voices within the Islamic world. Any that espouse what we might recognize as religious freedom are in the minority. And this also gets tied into the question of democracy. What is the relationship between religious liberty and democracy here? Because they're not coextensive.
That's exactly right. I mean, democracy, can mean different things, but the classical definition means rule by the demos, or rule by the people. So we think of elections and representation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we all know, you could have a kind of tyranny of the majority, or you could have a democracy where, you know, religious minorities are not respected.
Yeah.
Sometimes democracy can even encourage a dynamic of, you know, of religious repression, where the majority, in effect, wants certain minorities.
Yeah. I mean, this was the problem in Algeria, wasn't it, back in the early 90s? There was a
yes.
vote there, and then a subsequent civil war, because those who won the election were Sharia-focused or something. I'm drawing on vague memories here. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the problem in Algeria also was the government was what I would call a secular repressive government, did not want to allow Islamic parties to triumph, and so they prevented them from taking office after they had won the election, and then that's when the civil war ensued.
Yes, okay.
But your larger point about democracy can sometimes foment or encourage dynamics of repression is true. Countries like Pakistan, Indonesia, Malaysia are ones where, you know, in order as Islam became very popular and resurged in the 1970s and 1980s, leaders would also often appeal to a kind of very repressive form of Islam in order to gain popular support.
Yeah.
And in Indonesia, you know, we've seen a kind of increasing problems with religious freedom in the last 10 years or so, but has been done by leaders who really have gained popular support by turning against minorities.
So that's a way to gain popular support, to regard minorities as somehow a threat to social cohesion or national solidarity. So religious minorities then they become an enemy. They become a common enemy and draw people together. Is that it?
Yes, that's right. Like in Indonesia, for instance, there's the not exactly minority, but what's called the Ahmadiyya community, which is considered a kind of heretical form of Islam by mainstream Sunnis.
Right.
They're kind of like the Mormons of Islam. There's a prophet in the 19th century who they follow, and Sunnis regard that as you know, not legitimate. And but there have been great efforts to outlaw or make life very difficult for the Ahmadiyyas, and you know this is popular. There was also the recent Christian governor of Indonesia who elicited protests of hundreds of thousands out in the streets of Jakarta for actually making a kind of mild statement about the Quran that was regarded as offensive.
Right.
And so here, that's a perfect example of this kind of popular dynamic, whereas that resulted in his repression and removal and, you know, very hard time at the hands of the populace.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go and take a look at what are the seeds, you write about this in the book, what are the seeds of religious freedom within Islam? Where would you begin, or where would a committed Muslim begin to try to argue that it's in the interest of peace, it's in the interest of justice, it's in the interest of the dignity of the human person, or whatever formulation a Muslim might have. It's in those interests that religious freedom we need to move on towards religious freedom.
Yes, that's right. Now, these are the reasons for religious freedom, and central would be the intrinsic justice of it, the dignity of the person, the freedom of people and communities to live out answers to the most important questions in life. And then I would also point to second-order effects. Religious freedom is negatively correlated with civil war and terrorism, and positively correlated with democracy and peace and advancement of women and economic development. You know, it's a very good thing, a force multiplier, if you will.
Okay.
That the Muslim world suffers from a deficit of all those things and a surfeit of violence and terrorism. And so, religious freedom, I think, could be a very good thing for Muslim-majority countries.
Who's a champion? I mean, you mentioned a few earlier, but to my knowledge, they don't have a lot of popular support. You know, they're recognized in the West. But I realize the Muslim world is much more diverse than we may realize, but are there any first top-tier Muslim public intellectuals recognized, you know, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, who are champions of an Islamic religious liberty? Has it reached that level of discussion yet?
Well, you make a good point. Probably the leading intellectuals are in the West, and sometimes, frankly, can't go back to their countries.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
Because Mustafa Akyol, who we discussed a little while ago, he was detained in Malaysia for his interpretation. So, one wants to be honest about the difficulty and so forth. On the other hand, we do have some intellectuals like Mustafa Akyol and Abdullah Saeed. We have. Maybe one thing I could point to are certain statements where you have 130 intellectuals joining what was called the Common Word Statement in 2008, or what was more recently the Marrakesh Declaration, signed by 100, 200 Muslim intellectuals, where they are endorsing something like religious freedom or something very close to it. And so one can point to that. One can point to these 11 countries where it has actually been achieved. And there are certain political parties in places like Tunisia. The Ennahda Party is a good example of a Muslim movement that is, fairly sympathetic to religious freedom. So there are these kinds of, this is what I would call seeds of freedom. They're potentialities that could be developed further, while being honest that they're, they're islands in a larger sea.
So do the 11 countries that you're talking about, can a Muslim convert to Christianity in those countries without government reprisals?
Yes, by and large, yes. And that was one of the remarkable things that I discovered about the West African countries, which is that you can, in effect, commit apostasy. They would consider that a sin, but it's not considered a crime. You would not be subject to legal sanction for doing that.
Interesting.
And so for me, that was quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And, they're pretty robust, so they passed a pretty high threshold.
Okay. Well, let me go to another aspect of this. I can remember at the time that President George Bush was planning to go into Iraq, and part of the debate had to do with the future of Iraq and whether, in fact, Muslim-dominant countries, do they have the habits and dispositions to maintain a free society? And one of the arguments was we shouldn't sell them short. We shouldn't think that they're incapable of having values, what we would call First Amendment values, and that we have the responsibility to look upon freedom, and religious freedom in particular, as a universal human right, not a Western imposition. So if I were to stand up in the streets of Cairo and claim that religious freedom is a universal human right and not merely a Western imposition, how would that be received?
Well, you do put your finger on something. One of the kind of major sources of skepticism among many Muslims towards religious freedom is that it's, a Western imposition.
Yeah.
And sometimes they associate it with, like, Western license, like the kind of trends in sexuality and so forth. Other times they associate it with, say, Christian missionaries who they think that it's kind of a Trojan horse for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it all depends on what kind of culture you have in the country.
Okay.
Is it a widespread, kind of Islamist culture? Or the other dimension of the culture is what I call secular repressive, where there's a mentality in many Muslim countries of, wanting to sort of become a modern nation and sideline religion,
sort of
in the realm of the French Revolution. Well, that's not very friendly to religious freedom either. So you really need a kind of culture of religious freedom. I think that's what you had in West Africa, where you had the kind of long history of interreligious harmony and accommodation and so forth.
So,
and now, that's not to say it can't be developed, but you do need a kind of receptive culture.
So, I mean, in the Middle East, you had the Ba'ath Party in Syria and Iraq.
Yes.
You had Nasser's Egypt, and then, Sadat and Mubarak.
Right.
These are secular leaders. They were considered repressive, though, by at least certain Muslim groups. The Muslim Brotherhood certainly thought it was repressive. So Are those examples of the secular repressive leadership that you're referring to?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the points I make is that among the non-religiously free Muslim countries, some 40% of them follow not the religious repressive, but rather the secular repressive model, where you have a regime that is based on an ideal of modernization. They want to become like a modern European state. And then the argument they give is that you have to sideline and marginalize religion in order to do that.
Right.
Religion can only be a kind of medieval holdover. And in doing so, they've established very highly repressive regimes. I mean, Syria and Egypt are some of the torture capitals of the world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's because they, you know, just are making extensive efforts to kind of repress any kind of traditional form of Islam. I mean, the problem here is that these regimes are minorities and they're ruling over and against the, you know, religious heartland of their countries, where the populations are far more religious. And so they have to, they can only resort to repression. If they were to open themselves to democratic elections, they would lose.
They would lose, right. Great, yeah. Well, Dan, let me thank you again for your work generally and really for this most recent contribution. We'll talk again on it because it certainly would be nice to think that there's a constructive approach here. And I'd love to be able to encourage that as a distinct possibility for the future. We'll talk again. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Al. Love your show.
Dr. Daniel Philpott, Religious Freedom in Islam. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Are you fed up with the current healthcare system, paying too much for your healthcare cost? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. Visit SolidarityHealthShare.org to join like-minded Catholics in sharing medical expenses.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. The special initiative of Priests for Life and Anglicans for Life, called Healing the Shockwaves of Abortion, declares that abortion wounds everybody. In March, we focus on healing those who have lost a grandchild to abortion. They need help to know how to approach their son or daughter who was involved in the abortion, and to heal that relationship which the abortion has wounded. They need reassurance to commend their grandchild to the Lord, and His forgiveness if they have cooperated in or consented to the abortion. Many grandparents take part in Rachel's Vineyard retreats to mourn their lost grandchild. Let's pray each day this month for these grandparents, especially that they may face this pain which they may be trying to ignore. Find prayers and other information at abortionshockwaves.com. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me. And remember, Dan Philpott's book, Religious Freedom in Islam, is available in the online bookstore at AveMariaRadio.net, AveMariaRadio.net. And again, as I pointed out in conversations with Mustafa Akyol, years ago, you're going out on a limb. The history of Islam is fairly, as we started out the conversation, with Dan, both the history and the sociology here, it's pretty pessimistic. Nevertheless, you always hope that there'll be some light breaking forth on this question of religious freedom. And the fact that we have a few Muslim countries now that do not have any government reprisals or punishments for conversion could be considered progress. And it is interesting, too, that those particular areas in West Africa where this is the case are themselves not Middle Eastern. They're not really related to Middle Eastern. This is what's interesting about Islam, by the way. It's often thought to be an Arab phenomenon because it's still largely taught that you can't really understand the Quran unless you read Arabic. You read it in Arabic, the original language. So that's why there's been so, and of course the holy sites for Islam are in Saudi Arabia. And that's why Arab Islam, which is heavily Sunni, is often considered the dominant form. But again, we should be aware that it's not a monolithic religious tradition. Also, coming up next hour, we're going to be talking with Archbishop Nauman of Kansas City. What happens when a same-sex couple wants to send their child to a Catholic school? Well, a school chaplain in Kansas City recently faced that question, and we're going to talk about it with Archbishop Nauman. Look at how he reacted. And we're also going to be joined today by Sebastian Alvarez, coming up in the second half of next hour. He is a same-sex attracted man who wants to live according to the teaching of the church. He attended out at St. Paul's in New York. He attended Fordham. And he found that there's very little encouragement for Catholics who want to live according to the church in those LGBT communities. He'll tell us why. I'm Al Cresta. Stay with me. Got another hour coming up.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.